Embrace your inner space cowboy and listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies nobody else wants to talk about. This is episode number 67, and my name is Jakub.
And my name's Nick.
Right, okie dokie, wow. A long time no see, by the way, because I don't know if you know, this is the first time in, I think, 3 weeks that we're actually just recording again, because we had a bit of a break. So all the episodes that you've heard over the, I don't know, let's just call it the Easter break.
Yeah.
We're pre-recorded ahead of time. And like, we killed ourselves doing this. So, like, just to pretend the normality is preserved. This was great. Oh, shit. Like, next time someone's away, like, they will have to have like alternative arrangements, because, like, yeah, this was a lot of recording in a very short span of time. It's like running like 3 podcasts at a time.
Hard work, but it's paying off.
I don't know if it's paying off, though. Is it?
I'm happy, you know.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy. We're
if
happy,
I'm happy,
but
you're happy. Like, that's what counts. You know,
in terms of, like, money, not paying off. We're doing this for free, guys. Almost for free. I mean, yeah. Thanks to the Patreon, maybe at some point, I think the website's going to pay for itself.
Thank you, patrons.
Yeah, thank you, patrons. Speaking of, actually, might as well. What we've done, like, okay, well, because I think we've announced on previous week, previous episode last week when we did the Hitchcock film Lifeboat, we did announce that we'll be doing a bit of a series in May. So today we're not doing a series yet, we're doing something else. But starting next week, we're doing a series that we were referring to as the Shapeshifter series, but I think it's better to call it Shapeshifters and Body Snatchers, because there's just encompasses what we'll be talking about. So might as well just quickly list what we're going to be talking about, because it's quite a bit of stuff we'll be doing, both between the main show here and then patrons and then shows. And then, yeah, and then to that effect, I think if you're following the show, then probably the first episode of the series that's on the Patreon should be kind of in your feed as well already. Anyway, so what we're doing is, I think the general idea beforehand was kind of to kind of just do this in the run up to the 40th anniversary of John Carpenter's The Thing. Talk about some films that are kind of sort of related to it in one way or another. So the idea mm-hmm. would be to talk about The Thing from Another World, the film produced by Howard Hawks, Species, The Faculty, The Hidden, and then The Thing from 2011. And then that's on the main show over the next couple of weeks. And then on Patreon, we'll also hear us talk about Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978. And we'll do a retrospective on that's just body snatcher related films. So that will be Shivers, Invaders from Mars, and our boy Abel Ferrara's making an appearance again. Body Snatchers, yes. Or the Body Snatchers. Is it Body Snatchers or the
Body Snatchers? Body Snatchers.
Yeah. So we're doing a Ferrara film as well in there. And then also we'll be continuing our David Lynch sort of series by talking about Wild at Heart as well. So, you know, patreon.com/uncutgemspod is where you will find all the extra shows. $3 a month gets you there. And then on the main show, you'll have plenty of other stuff as well. And then might as well just mention that that's over the month of May, but the actual culmination of the series will happen in June, when to pair it up with The Thing remake in 2011. From 2011, we'll be doing a tie-in episode that will be released in June that will be on the actual John Carpenter's The Thing, and I cannot wait. I love this movie so much, and I never had an opportunity to talk about it in any serious manner. It's gonna be great
until next month.
Yeah, but meanwhile there's quite a lot of good stuff and good trash to talk about. So yeah, so there's gonna be that, but today we're not doing that. Today we're kind of sort of tying into May the 4th, which is this is kind of sort of like an, I think it's an official holiday, is it not? In America.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so we're tying into May the 4th, even though I think it's going to be released on May the 6th. Anyway, so last year we talked about Solo, A Star Wars Story, and you know, I think I was one of the few people who were maybe the only person who was actually seriously defending this movie.
In that conversation, yes. If I were, I wasn't there for that episode, but if I were, I would have defended you as well. It's a fun film.
That's what Kevin said. I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to defend this. And then he just changed his mind as we were going along through the conversation. Yeah, it was great. So yeah, go and listen to this. I think it's episode number like 15 or 16. I can't remember now. But yeah, so it's way back in the day, last year. So yeah, but today we're not doing an official Star Wars film. We're talking about Roger Corman produced and... Well, let's just call it a space opera Star Wars knockoff titled Battle Beyond the Stars.
What is it? What's happening?
A blank.
A what?
Soft light, no heat. I'm not damaged. I have a transmission.
I am Saint X-Men of the Valkyrie. I have counted coup upon you. It was a very enjoyable fight.
Enjoyable fight?
But then all fighting is enjoyable.
I have heard of your battle with the Malmori. I wish to join you.
Oh, yes? What are you going to do? Shoot blanks at Sador?
The Valkyrie are great warriors. In our youth, we must leave home and fight in many battles until we have proven ourselves.
Well, you've proven yourself to be a pain in the neck, so why don't you just fly off?
But I wish to fight.
My planet is in danger, and you're playing tag with me. Your ship is like a toy. You have no firepower.
It is one of the fastest in the universe.
Well, the Varda teach us that swift rain is little rain.
But I want to join.
Well, we don't want you. We don't need you, and we won't have you. So go count your coup somewhere else.
You were a little harsh, weren't you?
You saw her. She was playing with me.
Yes, and she won.
Would you like me to short-circuit your audio?
So directed by Jimmy T. Murakami, who also did When the Wind Blows, I think among other things. That's the only thing I kind of recognize in this filmography. And then produced by Roger Corman, Battle Beyond the Stars, Battle Beyond the Stars, Stars, lol. Richard Thomas, Robert Vaughn, George Pappard, John Saxon, Sybil Danning, Darlan Flugel, and a bunch of other folks. There's plenty of people in there. In a space opera about a farmer from a peaceful planet, Akir, who is sent on a mission to find mercenaries willing to defend his home planet against Sador, a ruthless conqueror threatening to enslave or even wipe out his entire planet with his mighty army of mutants and superior technology. So, Battle Beyond the Stars at the time of its release was the most expensive movie Roger Corman produced, and I'm not sure whether this sort of title still stands.
But, probably.
I haven't checked, so I don't know. So don't quote, yeah. And came out of sort of his desire to have a space opera under his belt, partly fueled by the immense success of Star Wars just a few years prior. And then, you know, the movie cost like $2 million to make, which was quite a lot of money for Roger Corman, let's just put it that way. Most of which went towards salaries for George Pappard and Robert Vaughn, who were quite expensive. So there's that. Anyway, the movie was shot at Corman's famous or infamous lumberyard facility in Venice, California, and a lot of interesting people were involved in the production of the film, which I think we'll touch on later on, but I don't know. Might as well just mention John Sayles, who wrote the script, James Horner, who did the music, James Cameron, who ended up being responsible for art direction, Gail Ann Hurd, who was an assistant production manager, and then she produced quite a lot of James Cameron's films, and even Bill Paxton, who was a carpenter on set. I'm just going to mention this. It's a trivia. Yeah. So Battle Beyond the Stars divided the critical opinion upon its release, with some critics praising it for its special effects and sort of, let's just call it, a good grasp of the space opera vibe, while others could not stand Corman's signature cheapo amateurism. I think that's, I can call this. But it made $11 million against $2 million of budget. So I think it made quite a lot of money. So in addition to, like, say, the 1978 Piranha, I think Roger Corman was kind of swimming in money at that time. And the film became a massive cult classic celebrated by nerds the world over. So tell me, Nick, what's your take on this movie? Are you a space cowboy? Tell me.
I'm not a space cowboy. I've said it in other episodes, I believe, but I'm not that big into sci-fi in general. And when I say sci-fi, I primarily mean space movies. I'm not a fan of space. We're talking about androids, dystopian futures, whatever. It works for me. We're talking about people going into space and their spaceships and shenanigans of that kind. You kind of lose me. which is why I really enjoy like Star Wars, because it's more of a fantasy in space. Meanwhile, something like Star Trek leans more heavily into the science aspect of science fiction. So, you know, I was curious about this film, about Battle Beyond the Stars, because of the Roger Corman connection. I really like Corman. I love his way of thinking. He is actually still alive, bless him. Both an artist and a great businessman. He knows what he wanted. He was basically kind of a proto Jason Blum. It's kind of like mm-hmm. him, you know. It's like, you know, you
proto
go cheap.
Jason Blum. I'm writing this down. We're gonna explore. I'm gonna pull you up on this in a second. Anyway.
Oh Jesus. Oh, no. In the sense that, like, he knew what he wanted, and when he had the other directors working on the movies that he produced, it was like, you need to have like all the tits, you need to have all the action, you need to have all the explosions, like don't leave out, like an audience member goes to a genre film to enjoy the genre, so don't blue ball them, basically. And Battle Beyond the Stars is definitely enjoyable in that sense. It has the fast pacing, you know, it's constantly moving forward. The main character is always like moving around from planet to planet, meeting different people, doing different things. And there's the quirky robot, and there's the sexy sidekick, and there's the goofy, weird, kind of anachronistic space cowboy that makes no sense if you think about it, but whatever. So it makes sense.
We're going to get to it. Don't worry.
There are a lot of elements. A lot of elements. And not all of them work. And I think it's primarily just overstuffed and painfully overly familiar. Mm-hmm. Because this is referencing not only Star Wars more blatantly, but also Seven Samurai and like Westerns of old, you could say.
Magnificent Seven, hello.
Just Seven Samurai copied Magnificent Seven. Like it's the endless circle. It's the endless circle. And I'm just kind of like, it's fine. Like, it's not a horrible movie. Even in terms of like cheapness of the effects, it looks pretty good, especially the remaster. It looks pretty nice. I think some of the backgrounds are kind of... in space.
That's James Cameron's work you're slagging off.
just the backgrounds, you know, because other parts work. I have to say, like, soundtrack, James Horner's first proper score, really good stuff, even if, again, very derivative. Overall, I'd say it's kind of a mixed bag, leaning more towards the positive than the negative, because it is an enjoyable experience in the moment. But it did kind of lose me in the last, like, 15 minutes. Because my brain, there was just so much going on, so many characters, just kind of like, just stop, just get to the end of this, stop introducing people, stop, like, there's a training montage, like, I don't care, stop. Jakub, what are your thoughts on Battle Beyond the Stars?
Look, I was thinking long and hard about how I'm going to kind of just try to express what I'm actually thinking about this film, because a lot of the stuff in here I agree with. Not sure I've seen too many films that Roger Corman produced.
Well, the Edgar Allan Poe productions. Ooh.
Possibly. Maybe good Humanoids stuff. From the Deep, I see. I saw someone. Maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, really.
Death Race. He loves Stallone.
Oh.
Death Race 2000.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I've seen Death Race 2000. Yeah. But this would have been like 20 years ago. So yeah, you know, my memory is like not getting better. It's actively getting worse. So I'm sitting down to watch this, and I'm sitting down, and I immediately see how much of a knockoff of 1977 Star Wars this is in just so many ways, while also being like, you know how certain films reference, like, you think they're like knocking off a film, but they're reaching through this film to the source material this movie is actually based on. So you can see how this is, yeah, like, I don't know, like, you could accuse George Lucas of like ripping off Hidden Fortress, right? And mm-hmm. then saying like, I and making it in space. He's pretty much doing Seven Samurai in space, but he's doing it also via John Sturges in Magnificent Seven because it's overtly a Western, right? And, you know, and then there's the familiarity is like a double-sided blade, if you know what I mean, because it's sort of like, yeah, I like the fact that they are just doing this sort of indie, sort of like I don't know how to call this, cheapo knockoff of something that I'm intimately familiar with, while at the same time I'm just thinking to myself, I could as well just watch the originals.
Yes.
So because it's, yeah, let's just say the movie's not good. Let's just say, like, if you have to, you can't sit down and watch a Roger Corman production just thinking you're watching Schindler's List. Like, this is not something you just sit down and think to yourself, like, I'm going to, you know, like, put my prestige hat on and then just examine this the way I examined The Northman in the cinema, because I just saw it last week, right? Like, this is not experience. Like, you have to kind of just, I'm sitting down to watch a pile of trash, and then I'm just trying to kind of just see if whether this trash aligns into a picture I recognize, right? But sort of my sort of mnemonic sort of device I just devised for myself was, you know, I don't know, this would be for people who are like musically inclined. Like, if you're into, I don't know, let's just say Metallica, for instance, and you listen to their early shit, you'll see that their early shit isn't as original as you know. Because, well, if you listen to their like Black Album or Master of Puppets, you can probably see this is their voice. This is them on the plate. But if you listen to their demos from like the early 80s and then whenever they're formed, this film is kind of like an equivalent of like listening to like Kirk Hammett and James Hetfield and all these people just like meeting in like in a high school band where they don't really have their own material. They don't have their own voice. What they have is what they love. And they get together and they just play music and they make these sort of shitty songs that are kind of sort of inspired by the stuff they like to listen to. And then you can see that there's talent in there, that these people know how to shred, kind of, but they still have lots to learn. But there's like potential somewhere in there, but the music overall is crap. So this is kind of like where I'm sitting with this film. Because it's like, I honestly had, like when you said, oh, by the end, it's so overstuffed. Like, I had to watch the ending twice. Because I lost track of what the fuck's happening. And it's just so messy. But there are so many things. There are a few things, and this is kind of just going back to my like high school band analogy. It's kind of like finding like a demo tape of like a Joe Satriani's high school band where you can see there's this talent somewhere in there, and this talent's James Horner. Because it's kind of like he's like the sort of, I don't know, he's like the cinematographer in Ty West's X. Like, they're making a porno, but he's making it look like a new wave film.
Well put.
Like, they've hired an artist to kind of just like, who has this immense talent, and he has this like shitty film to score. And I can honestly think, I don't know how they scored this film, whether the orchestra was like playing while looking at this film as well, just for inspiration, and all the sort of violinists were like, what the fuck, why are we watching? But the music is great, and we're gonna get to it, because I have a few bits of, because James Horner is just so self-referential, it's great. But the film overall is weird, because I don't think I want to watch it ever again. But I'm glad I have seen it. I'll put it that way.
It's a curio. It is one of those movies. You're glad you've seen it. It's like, now I'm done.
So it's a bit weird. And then, you know, and I'm just wondering, like, okay, what makes it a cult classic? Like, is it because of the Corman connection? Because it's just, you know, it's just a shitty, trashy sort of indie film that for some reason was made on a massive budget. For what it is, or is it because of the Star Wars connection, or is it what is it? Tell me, why is this a cult classic?
Two reasons, in my opinion. First of all, yes, absolutely the Star Wars connection. That's 100% the main reason, because it has so many elements taken straight out of it. that, especially considering that it came out in 1980, same year. I don't even know if it's like very close in terms of release date, but it's the same year as Empire Strikes Back.
It came out September, and then I think Empire came out May.
There you go. So it's like a...
I wonder if they made it like in the sort of like 3 months between the two.
That'd be even funnier, honestly. That'd be funnier.
I wouldn't be surprised if the score wasn't finished, because there are certain bits of the score that look like they're trying to be inspired by the Imperial March. But anyway, just tell me.
That's definitely something that made it a cult classic, because I always feel that whenever you have a movie that's as successful as Star Wars, people want to cash in, and like we talked about it with Jaws and countless other classics, and so many of them just don't work because they try to be too different, or they are excessively like cheap, poorly made. And I think this one is overall just all right in terms of like production value, the way it's put together. There's nothing that's egregiously horrible. So it's like, yeah, the performances are not good. Like, everyone's acting like they are in a different movie. John Saxon clearly is there just for a paycheck. Probably was there for like 3 days total of shooting. Like, that's how the entire movie feels. It doesn't feel like the big names are actually putting in the effort, and the ones who are not big names are trying way too hard to stand out.
What's the guy's name? The main characters. Oh, hold on. What
is it? Richard Thomas.
Richard Thomas. Yes. Like, he's really trying. Like, he's just like, notice me, Dino De Laurentiis. Notice me.
He was in freaking It as well. It was like the older guy from It, the original like miniseries.
Really? Yeah. Oh, right.
Oh, a few years later, a decade later.
But that was
so,
his...
you know.
Yeah, because I'm looking at this film. He didn't really have much of a career, did he?
No.
Not in film, though. In television, he has quite a lot.
I can see him working well in television, you know. It's the type of more heightened performance.
Film sort of credits. And he kind of just like, yep, not much. Okay, well, 70s, 60s, 70s, 80, then 89. And then few credits in the 2000s. Meanwhile, television films, there's like 70 of them.
Jesus.
And then TV shows, like even more.
Well, you know, he's working. He's bringing the bread home. Bless him. But yeah, so you have that side of like the Star Wars connection. But also, I think this ended up becoming a cult classic because it's serviceable. And when you have a big sea of just shit like pale imitations of Star Wars and other sci-fi narratives, you can kind of go, hey, but there's a Battle Beyond the Stars right over there. Do you see it? It's kind of like something that you've seen before, but it's a bit cheap and campy, and like people love camp. That's kind of like one of those things, you know, that's very popular nowadays. Everything that makes you laugh has to be in a weird way just good on its own, because it's camp. It started off as a kind of an offensive term, and now it's becoming an excuse to justify some poor films, in my opinion. But I can see that kind of being the appeal for this film. Silly, it has some very weird lines. It has some even imaginative moments, to be honest. There are some parts where I was going kind of like, okay, this is a neat idea. I think we'll get to it. There's like a, I don't even remember. It's like this planet of androids,
Is it a planet or is it like a station? Because it's essentially like
station.
It's like I don't know. It's almost like it follows this archetype of like a Greek poem. Almost like there's this guy who's sent on a mission. He goes from place to place, like the sort of the 12 tasks of Hercules, right? Like he's going
like Odysseus.
To go. Yes, it is kind of like the Odyssey, right? That
the island where you have the androids.
The android place, what is it called? It's called Hephaestus. It's the space station of Dr. Hephaestus, which is, you know, if both people who don't know, that's a Greek god.
Hephaestus.
So, I mean, in Polish, it's Hephaestus. I don't know. So that's how I remember it. So, you know, like the guy who lives in a volcano, he's the blacksmith, right?
Yes.
And he's kind of like the sort of the manly man voice of reason who just like keeps like Ares in check and shit like this. And then he tells Zeus to stop fucking around.
And his wife is cheating on him. Fun stuff.
He's married to. Venus. Venus is Roman. So what? Aphrodite.
Aphrodite.
Yes. So he's a massively, a very manly sort of hairy bloke who's married to this princess. It's just great.
A manly cuck.
Wow. Wow. He's probably packing. That's why he's married to Aphrodite. He's probably just he has a hammer in his pants. Anyway.
Speaking of Battle Beyond the Stars.
I'm just thinking to myself, like, what makes this a cult classic? And it's just like, because when you think about these like shitty, trashy, by the way, the sort of term camp, what does it actually mean? Like, for me, this always meant elevated to the point of ridiculousness, right? Like
this, and intentionally so most of the time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, wink, wink, we're having fun at the expense of the shitty material we're in. So have fun with us. Like, that's how I always see this. Like, but then, as you say, like, it's recently, it's kind of like, don't you get it? It's camp. It's kind of like, well, you just like a shitty film. Just admit it. That's fine. It's fine. It's fine to like House of Gucci. if you're really into it, but yeah,
it doesn't seem like camp.
not necessarily camp. I mean, there's one character in House of Gucci who is camp, and that's the cartoon character who's clearly in a different planet. But in here, like, and when I think about these sort of camp, trashy sort of B movies that kind of get the cult classes, they're usually quotable like all hell. And I'm not sure this film's quotable.
No.
Like, there will be people just shouting lines at a midnight screening. And I cannot possibly imagine this happening here. Like, what are you.
Yeah, I don't think I've even written down any. There's literally just one quote that I wrote down that will make an appearance later on.
Oh my.
That's literally the only thing I wrote down. In terms of quotes,
please tell me if this quote involves kissing.
No.
Okay, so there's going to be two quotes that are going to make an appearance.
And that's also another one of the problems. Honestly, think about it. What's one of the key successes of Star Wars? Easy to remember names that just roll off your tongue: Luke, Leia, Han, Chewbacca, Yoda. It's like it's very easy.
Not even Chewbacca, Chewie.
Chewie, Vader, Obi-Wan, Ben Kenobi. It's like it's easy. Then you go to this one. It's like Shad, Gelt, Sador.
I almost asked who's Shad, and it's like, no, that's the main character.
That's the protagonist. Nanilia, Cowboy, my favorite character, Cowboy. That's the only one you remember.
But then there are these characters. There's this like reptilian looking guy, and I'm just looking up in like just what was his name, because I have him somewhere in my notes. It's like Cayman of the Lazuli. Okay. And I'm just like, what are these guys who kind of look like they're from like THX 1138, the ones with stuck on third eye on their forehead? And it's like, it's Nestor. Oh, okay, great. And it's like literally, like even the planet, and it's just like, well, okay, what's the planet called again? It's a Kurosawa reference. That's great.
And also, there's like this. What's the? I think there's a Agnes Varda reference because they keep talking about the Varda.
Oh.
It's like this power. It's kind of like the force for this.
Yeah, they have they have the Varda, and because this is something.
Is it an Agnes Varda reference? I don't think so. I hope it is. But,
maybe it is. I don't know. Ask John Sayles. I don't know. Because I don't know. But in all fairness, like I watched the film, and then I read the synopsis and just a whole plot sort of summary on Wikipedia again, just to just remember exactly what I want to mention and where. And I'm just thinking to myself, have I actually watched this film? Like, have I fallen asleep? Like, no, it's not possible. Because I'm like reading these bits, I'm like, I have no recollection of shit that happened in this film. Like some films like, okay, fine. Okay, so you blew up a planet. I didn't notice.
They blew up a planet?
Yeah, there's this, because they have this, you know, okay, well, in Star Wars, there's, you know, like the Death Star, and it has this sort of, you know, the power, it can, it's a planet destroyer, right?
Yes.
So they have this stellar something. Let me just tell you. Hold on. Where is it?
Bargain bin, that star.
Stellar Converter, that's what it's called.
Again, a weapon that turns planets
into small stars. So it's essentially just the Death Star, right? So, and by the way, his Stator's ship's called Hammerhead. I don't know if you knew that. So there's this lore in this film that apparently people care about, or maybe the filmmakers care about. It does not come across like at all to me.
No.
I could just... But yeah, I felt like, you know, last time I felt like this was when I watched Black Dahlia for this show, where it was just like this information that's coming in my eyes and immediately gets ejected because there's just no, I don't care for some reason. All I want is just, I don't know. This film is not simple enough, and it should be simple. Yeah. I think that's the main sort of criticism I would level at this. Apart from like, oh, it just looks like it's made of styrofoam, right? But yeah.
Which again, there's enough variety, I'd say, in the sets, in the costumes, that make it feel less cheap than other wannabe Star Wars that clearly didn't have the budget for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of the credit has to go to the crew that worked on it, because they worked their ass off. But yeah, it's like fast food. It's like the cheapest type of fast food, because it fills you up, and in the moment you kind of go, yeah, that was all right, and then you just have stomach pain for a bit,
mm-hmm.
and then morning after, go to the toilet, flush it down, and then you even forget you had it.
Exactly. Although, oh, you see, here's something. The film on, it's like, let's just say on a primary level, as in like, here's a film I'm engaging with. Like if I had to watch it like a festival critic who doesn't have a, like, it's like, I don't care whether this is referencing, you know, Seven Samurai or Magnificent Seven. I don't mind. All I'm here is for what I'm seeing, and I'm going to report back about how I felt, because that's how I view, like, more like the contemporary reviewers are like, me like film, good film, 5 stars. It's just okay. So on this level, it's just the story is kind of like, it's too complex for its own good. The plot's kind of just weird. It's anchored around interesting things, but it doesn't compel because these characters are shit. Like, they're just unidimensional. What makes this film for me is how it's made. Because I actually, you know, like, I watch these sort of models, like, you know, there's plenty of these sort of, this imagery, this sort of big ship just flying over. And that's James Cameron's work, right? These miniature models are amazing. And then, fun fact, they all look like they will be inspiring the ships in Aliens or the ships in the Terminator in the sort of flashbacks from the future.
Coincidence?
Not so much. I think this is just a sign of something like, I like that kind of shit. I'm going to put it in my stuff when I'm done in here. As a space opera, it's just like I can feel exactly like I felt when I was watching Crawl.
Yes.
No?
Yes. Yes.
It's like the film Crawl was bad, like a bad fantasy. Like, you can't, I was just sitting there with matchsticks on my eyelids, just please, just let it finish. And then what kept me going was James Horner's music, or like the set designs or miniatures and stuff, like the filmmaking. Yeah,
Neeson. Just confusingly being there.
Just Liam Neeson being there. Although I do prefer him more in Darkman. Take the fucking elephant. It's great. Like when you mentioned like George Peppard. Saying like I can clearly see how he doesn't want to be there, and he goes like when I can't remember, Jimmy Murakami or Roger Corman would just tell him, it's like, you grab this stick and you pretend this shoots lasers, and he goes like, okay, pew pew pew, like, he clearly does not give a shit, like, he's not like, okay, I'm embracing this is, you know, I'm going to go full De Niro on this.
Yeah, and I don't get the choice for his character. Like, why does he exist? Why do it's just an excuse to have like super banal fish out of water jokes, but like inverted. Mm-hmm. Because he keeps making references to old classic westerns, and he has hot dogs, and he brings them to the aliens, and they go like, "What is this?" It's like, "Oh, that's a hot dog."
That's
like,
not a dog.
That's not a dog. This has like trash inside, and blah blah blah. And it's like, "Yep, that's what we eat on Earth." Oh, it's like what? Am I...
But how the old, wow, like clever. Only one bites it, but everyone chews. it's so great.
I bet it, that's explained in the lore in some way. There's just like a super like a, fan.
Yeah, there's gonna be like a whole, I don't know, series of fan fiction based on this crap somewhere.
And there's like a wiki, like five people bought it.
There's a wiki for this movie, and there must be one, right? But like with George Papad, there's an interesting sort of wrinkle to him, because he's kind of like a fish out of water, which suggests that this doesn't take place in, like, well, let's just say in a galaxy a long, long time ago, right?
Yeah.
It's just there's Earth in this universe, and then he just got snatched out of like the Old West, and he had to go like, well, I guess I'm flying ships now. And
but is it the Old West? Because like he's aware of what hot dogs are. Does he make them? Does he produce hot dogs? Or does he have like a massive freezer of hot dogs in his ship? How does that work?
Do you think he's like a massive nerd? Like he's a nerd from Earth who's just like massively into Westerns?
Yes, yes, of course. He's basically like cosplaying as a Western cowboy.
He's a cosplaying nerd. Oh, great. It actually makes it even better when you think about it, but you know, I don't know. I watch this and I'm just like I'm in awe of what's in front of me. As in, like, look, like when you think about it, like this, they look at the set design and someone tells me like they made this model out of like a McDonald's container, and you're like, that's great, looks amazing. And then they will show you like these special effects that are really crap, or I was actually, this is a note I have, how cleverly they hide the fact that they literally don't have zero money for this movie. Because I think Roger Corman went and asked some kind of a special effects studio how much it would take for them to actually make special effects for them, and they said to him $2 million.
That's my like, budget.
That's my budget. I don't know, I have to buy film stock for this.
Yeah, it's the actors, the special effects.
Yeah, so there's that, and then you know, so apparently that, you know, they didn't have money anyway, because like there were like people doing multiple jobs on set. But I'm actively amazed by how they're hiding seems. Like, did you imagine like what this film has plenty of like androids and robots, but they're cleverly hidden. Because mm-hmm. they're either actors who pretend to be robots, as this on this Hephaestus station, there's this guy who goes like, or they're very just confusing. Voices. Or they're just voices. There's this cheeky sort of AI on a ship, which I kind of like.
That's a highlight.
Reminded me of the voice of the android in Rogue One.
Oh, I thought we were going to say in Solo.
Was it in Solo?
It's the one in Solo as well, yeah.
No, that's the one in Solo. It's like, don't look. Like, congratulations, you're being rescued. That's in Solo. Yeah, that's the one.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge, yep.
Waller-Bridge, yes. So she's like this cheeky sort of cynical. It's like, I don't know what to do. Well, I can't help you. Just grab the stick and point and shoot. How do I do it? Just what I told you.
That he doesn't want to shoot. I don't want to kill. Then she's like, fuck it, I'll just shoot him yourself. But you cannot do it. Sometimes you just have to do some things, you know, it's fine. And that's kind of interesting. I was reading up some reviews of people that I follow. And I mean, a few of them said that this movie has very interesting philosophical things to talk about that other action adventure sci-fi movies don't.
Such as?
I don't necessarily... the main character has an interesting arc. At least there's an arc. He's not just goody two shoes who's ready to go out and kill people and whatnot. He goes through like, well, you know, I want to save my people. I'm just a farmer. I don't want to kill anyone. I want to outrun them if I can, or outsmart them if I can, all of my enemies. But I don't want to kill anyone. And he has to learn that, well, yes, you do need to kill people. And then he just becomes crazy with blood.
No, it's just his transition's kind of like, well, fine, okay. He's not like Desmond T. Dawson Hacksaw Ridge when he's like, no, I'm not doing this. I'm going to be kicking grenades. Fuck
off. Not like vomiting or I killed someone.
No, he's just, I suppose.
It's very, yeah. Like, that's what I find very cute, though, in a way, that people who really love this movie try to find a lot of ways to defend it. So it's like, it has deep characters, and it goes in different directions that other movies don't. It's like, well, yeah, sure, Luke never says I don't want to kill anyone, but it's not like there's no other things to his character. I can't remember other aspects of this main protagonist's characteristics. He's just there.
He's very plain, but he's kind of hidden under this sort of like heavy sort of layer of frosting of lore.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like, he's visiting these places and you're just almost more interested in, what is this guy Gelt all about? And then he tells you all about this sort of, I don't know, these planets that got together to wipe him out because he was too dangerous or something like this.
And he makes a joke or two.
Yeah. Which, you know, I don't know. But it's weird. It's because on one hand, I like that kind of world building that's kind of just, you know, here's just like an unsolicited remark about the Clone Wars or something like this. I like that kind of world building that gives you depth but doesn't really just beat you over the head with exposition.
Mm.
But I think after a while, it kind of becomes this exposition. It's just, yeah, here's this world a bit more. It's just, I don't know.
It's anyway, you were saying. Well. that's it. It's every single character is just one note, very flat and dull. Ladies are there to be sexy, men are there to be strong and buff, and everyone's making jokes. In a weird way, you could even say it kind of fits into today's output of movies. Like, if this came out nowadays, it'd have all of the hallmarks of, like, this is trying to capitalize on the success of the Marvel movies and the new Star Wars, because it has, like, the only thing it's lacking is, like, I don't know, diversity in the cast. That's true. The only thing it's lacking.
They have a reptile, come on. They have furries, true, definitely they have furries.
Furries, they have artificial intelligence. There's it's... So, you know, there's one lady who's a badass, the other who's there to be saved, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, it would feel like they're just taking off boxes nowadays. It's kind of fun watching it in that way. But other than that, it's enjoyable. That's kind of I wasn't hating myself watching it, but it did get to a point where you just don't care. I think of all the actors, John Saxon as the villain is forgettable as hell. Like, he is the only one who's there for a paycheck and that's it. He has nothing to do. He is in the same exact set every single time they cut back to him. I don't think he never leaves that room. He's like in this control room on his planet.
In the torture sequence, I think that kind of takes place somewhere else, doesn't it?
It's in the room right next to it, probably.
Yeah, just next door.
It's just next door.
I do like in his sets, it kind of goes for different sets as well, which I think this is something that James Cameron then just fell in love with a little bit. The blue tint. Everything's kind of like a lot of scenes are kind of just washed in blue.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a color that I associate with James Cameron.
He loves blue.
He likes blue. But I feel like it hides imperfections. Like, it kind of looks a bit more artsy that way. So that you don't, we wouldn't, it's like, oh, I'm not looking at people in shitty makeup and, you know, standing against styrofoam sets, right? It kind of looks a little bit more sort of involved, and then they play with shadows, they play with color a bit better, and it kind of looks like it's made by people who kind of know what they're working with. Like, they're not pretending, you know, like there will be like indie filmmakers who just have $100,000 and then they have actors who have zero talent and they really actively want to make a Judd Apatow comedy and it doesn't work, but they feel like they're doing a Me Too sort of attempt at something that a Hollywood filmmaker with a lot of clout and talent would pull off.
Yeah,
they kind of know what, you know, the material they have to work with, and they know the talent they have on display, and they're probably happy to have George Peppard just pretend to have a blaster in the hand. it's just weird that way.
They got really lucky. I think we've like one, like if they didn't have Jim Cameron or even just James Horner working on the sets and working on the music respectively, like you already lose those two guys, you lose 50% mm-hmm. of the entertainment.
More than that, I'd say.
It looked cheap. Because
if the sets were cheap, if the models weren't absolutely jaw-dropping for what they are,
mm.
and the music wasn't there, there's absolutely zero interest for me like I would struggle to watch the film start to finish. And then I don't know.
Yep.
It's a very odd experience. And speaking of music, by the way, did you notice a few connections in the music? I want to do this.
It felt very familiar, but I have to say I haven't watched Aliens in quite a long time.
All right.
So there's Aliens connections, I'm lost.
There's a few Aliens connections, but one I actually found sound bites for, so I might as well just quickly find them. But speaking of, that's in the scene where they have this massive this film kind of comes into its own, like almost say after an hour, for exactly 20 minutes, because in the last 10 minutes I'm like, I have no idea what the fuck is happening. But when they actually go into battle, and there's this space battle, and then there's this assault in like caves, and these sort of soldiers dressed in black, and mm-hmm. kind of looks like Star Wars almost, like they have these sort of hatches closing, and there's the shootouts, and there's these, they use these special powers to do certain things, and this guy, what is it called, Geld, dies, and then it's a very dramatic moment, and it almost feels like it's taking out of like a 1950s western when he's dying, and it's just like, can you please die, like it's been 3 minutes, it's not Rio Bravo, just hurry up
holding him in their arms.
But you know, the film kind of, hold on, I'll find this, hold on. That's a track called "The Battle Begins," and then I don't have like a, okay, for this part of this track I don't have like look for this, but it feels almost like it's an Alien soundtrack. The sort of the drums in there, the snares are great, but there's this moment in, I think it's gonna be here somewhere. These two notes. I just wanted to find this. Hold on.
Ooh, la la.
Like it's just, I don't know, a few tones lower.
What is it from?
That's from Aliens. That's a track called Queen to Bishop, which is the moment where they escape the LV-426 and they're on the ship, and then everything's fine and everyone's great, and then Lance Henriksen gets a tail through the chest, just and this is when this music kind of And then you see the queen coming out of this hatch, and then yeah. So that's the same sort of motif is during the sort of big space battle, where this is where the film comes into its own, and just because and then the reason why it comes to its own is because all I'm seeing is close-ups of models going boo boo, boo boo, and this music, and then no one's really ruining anything with too much dialogue because they can't speak for shit. But then here's another piece of music that. This tells you how much Horner loves himself. Hold on. This is going to be great. Again. That's the main title, by the way, for Battle Beyond the Stars. That's kind of almost like Aliens again, right?
Very nice reverb, yeah. Did he make the Rocketeer? Did he make the music for the Rocketeer?
Oh, I think so. But
because I just like just listening quickly, to this, I was like,
Google this. But what this by the way, Horner is horny for horns. He's horny for horns. Like the horns and
it was.
The horn section in his, like, you can, I don't know, maybe at this point maybe I'm confident enough when I hear a soundtrack I'll be like, this is a James Horner soundtrack. Not even if I don't hear the flourish that he always kind of puts in somewhere. But what this music is very similar to is this one, which is going to be
Big Rocketeer, man.
Just pay attention to the horns. I'm not gonna say it's note for note the same, but
it's very
Do you know what film this is from?
No.
You don't know? We talked about it on the show.
Crawl.
Oh. It's the main theme from Crawl.
Oh.
And it's only 3 years after this. Like Aki clearly was like, I love the vibes I had on this Corman shitty film. I'm gonna put it in everything.
This is it. I've peaked in my career. I can only copy myself early. Now.
he's an early finisher.
He did make some good soundtracks. I mean, he made Braveheart as well, didn't he?
Oh, he made quite a lot of great soundtracks. I don't see the main. I've seen like these think pieces in places where it's just like, oh, Horner's just ripping off classical musicians. Oh, Horner's ripping off this guy and that guy. Like, everyone's ripping off musicians. You just don't recognize them. Like, I don't know. Like John Williams is also like massively self-referential. Like Jerry Goldsmith is self-referential. But yeah, I don't know. I like Horner's music because it's always kind of like very very horn-based.
I mean, he also made the soundtrack to Commando, and that's the best soundtrack of all time. So, you know.
He did. But could you imagine, like, the guy who then ended up scoring these massive blockbusters, he was starting out on a Roger Corman space opera made on a shoestring budget where, like, James Cameron was sleeping on the set while painting sets. And then they had these stories that they had to hire a guy, pay him like $5 to kind of just keep a lookout if Roger Corman would show up on set, because when people were working on like painting shit, he would not like anything, but if he arrived on set and no one was there, he would say like, this looks nice. So he apparently was then telling people to hide, so then Roger Corman would approve the shit they were working on instead of throwing it out. It's just great.
What a guy. Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah, it's such a weird film. And then, yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've padded the episode with this music business. Because honestly, I was just like, if we hit an hour of this with this episode, this is gonna be an achievement.
Surpassing Crawl.
Yeah. No, oh, yeah. But then I had one little note extra I wanted to kind of just pick your brain on. Because I sometimes watch these films, especially these trashy ones. And then when you don't feel like, I don't know, if I feel like I'm not getting what I think I could be getting from the primary narrative, like I just feel like, is there an interpretation I can project onto this? And I'm watching this and it kind of feels like, is this relevant to our current socio-political climate? Like with the war in Ukraine, for instance, when you have this guy who just like shows up at someone's doorstep and goes like, I'm going to be back in like X months time. And then either you're going to be my slaves or I'm going to kill all of you. Bye. Right? Is state or Putin is what I'm trying to say.
Or rather, is Putin a villain? A cartoonish villain from Westerns and samurai flicks of old?
That pretty was much, yeah.
Off, you know?
Yeah. So I think that, yeah. It's, I don't know.
It's a bold statement to make.
Like ascribing a social commentary onto a film like this would be like, I don't know if it's flattering to the film or if it's something like, please just don't.
There's probably going to be a very like long think piece on why this movie predated a lot of things. It was actually very prescient.
It was, yeah. I mean, you could fish for like allegorical interpretations and see this like, is this an allegory for colonialism, right? Or the sort of, you know, because you could honestly see this, that Sator in this massive technology is basically like the British Empire traveling around the world and telling you, hi, India, this is mine now. So like that's pretty much what they did, right? Or just going to Africa and saying like, I like it here. We're staying. And you people, you locals, I don't like you. And then just kill all of you because you're like, we're massively superior in terms of our development, so we don't care. That's, you know, main gist. And
unfortunately, yeah.
But I kind of like the sort of idea that it's loosely, it's actively ripping off Seven Samurai. And to me, Magnificent Seven is what it's ripping off. Like, it's like I don't know, connecting this to Kurosawa is almost feels like a slap on the face.
I mean, if they did put Akira, though, I think when you put Akira, you don't even go like, it's primarily Magnificent Seven. It's like, no, they're ripping off both of them.
Well, yeah.
Explicitly. Just
and
shameless. Then, you know,
like, they have George Peppard being this. Okay, so who's Yul Brynner in this film?
Or like, Robert Vaughn?
Robert Vaughn, yeah. Or who's...
He doesn't die. Who died? Yeah. Who's the guy who...
Is it Toshiro Mifune?
No, I was thinking in the Magnificent Seven.
Oh.
The guy, what's... Charles Bronson dies in that one?
Most of
Steve McQueen. Does Steve McQueen die?
I don't think he does. I mean, it's been a few years. Magnificent Seven. Not the one from 2016. 1960.
My favorite. It's from everyone's favorite modern author, Anton Fuqua.
What? You stay away from Anton Fuqua.
I watched it in the cinema, hey. So, you know, I was hyped.
Anton Fuqua doesn't get the attention he should get because he's a massively successful filmmaker of color in Hollywood that kind of gets to work on, well, he used to get to work on really big projects, and then no one gives a shit. Did Eli Wallach die?
Isn't he a villain?
Is Eli Wallach a villain? I think he is. Hold on.
He's not part of the Seven.
Seven is Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Horst Buchholz, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn, Brad Dexton, James Coburn. Okay, Eli Wallach is Calvera, so yeah, he's the chief.
James Coburn was in the group?
Yeah, he's the knife guy.
Oh, no. It's been a while. It's been since 2016. I remember why we did like a marathon of all of them before the new one.
Wow. No, but if you think about this, in 1960, having Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn, and James Coburn, and Eli Wallach in one film, it's a big deal.
And they weren't even that famous back then, most of them.
Well, they were just about there, I think. Well, maybe Charles Bronson was probably just getting there.
Charles Bronson, Eli Wallach. It's like the Dollar Trilogy is 2 years after.
Yeah,
3 years. So.
So I'm just looking at this, and then from perspective of time, this is a. Just, I don't know.
And then you have Battle Beyond the Stars, and no one remembers anyone. It's like, I guess John Saxon and George Papard.
Yeah. And who are these people? And it's like, why are they so well paid? It's like, oh, they used to be big. But then, by the way, I've never told anyone. Have you ever seen Westworld?
The original, like Yul Brynner.
Yeah, that's the one. Not the TV show. I haven't seen the TV show.
Yeah, it's all right. First season's
but
good.
I saw Westworld before I saw The Magnificent Seven.
Oh, la la.
And this, you know, this messed with my brain because Yul Brynner, I mean, actively now, it makes Westworld even better because Yul Brynner is this sort of Terminator android who just goes on a rampage and just starts killing people. He's dressed in black and just goes on an absolute nightmarish rampage, just killing everyone. So in my head, I imagined that Yul Brynner would be a villain. And I watched Magnificent Seven and he's like the sweetest guy.
He has a menacing face, you know.
Because he's Russian, right? So I told you once before, like the Slavs have a resting bitch face. Like when we're neutral, people think we're angry. And then for some reason, I was just thinking, like, he's one of the heroes. What's going on in here? So I had this sort of. Yeah, and then it kind of makes Westworld even better because he's taking a hero from this beautiful film from this 1960 and he's making him a villain. It's great. It makes Westworld look like a masterpiece. Anyway, that's pretty much all I had to mention about
same
this film.
Honestly.
So I think we're done in here, aren't we? Yeah, because I don't really have much more to say because there's only so much I can say about, like, James Horner's music is just great all around. And there's just a few bits and pieces that I might as well mention, you know, when we were going through our top and bottom threes.
Yeah, I have them ready.
Yeah, but like in overall terms, it's a movie that is just like, it's just weird. So how about the final take? What's your final take?
Battle Beyond the Stars. Like I said before, it's just fast food. It's if you're into sci-fi of a very like, you know, adventurous variety, give it a watch. It's enjoyable. It's kind of fun. It's very light, especially. It's 105 minutes long. Getting kind of Get Out. Not really. It's a bit too long, honestly, for what it's trying to do. But again, like there's enough entertaining aspects to it to make it a worthwhile watch to genre fans. But if you're not a big fan of the genre, like myself, you're going to forget about it instantly as soon as you're done. You're not going to hate yourself watching it. It has some fun moments here and there. But overall, it's just very forgettable.
Yeah. Agreed. this way. It's on the same sort of shelf as Crawl is. Like, I'm happy to have seen it, and I'm happy not to have to sit through it again.
It's logged. It's ticked off. It's done.
It will come with a recommendation of a specific kind. Like, I wouldn't recommend it to my like work colleagues and say, "How about you watch this Roger Corman film from 1980?" But I would recommend it to someone who like watches films with the sort of explicit eye for filmmaking in there. So if, I don't know, if I can talk with someone, like I would recommend it to you. It's like, because if you watch All the President's Men with me, and I'll tell you, look at the zoom. Mm-hmm. You see Robert Redford? Like, they're shooting him from across the street, 100 meters away, with this massive long zoom, and then they're zooming out as you go. Like, it's brilliant, right? And then you'll probably say, yeah, it is brilliant. So you kind of have to watch it with this sort of, you know, like I have to be able to pause it while we're watching together. It's like, listen to the horns in this section of the score, and you'll be like, yeah, this rocks. Or like, look at the models. This is fabulous. Or look at the lighting on Seder, like clearly just covering a shitty makeup. And then he probably by the way, just John Saxon probably didn't even allow himself to because all these mutants have this scar, and then he's the only person who doesn't have a scar. He probably goes like, "Fucking get the fuck away from with this makeup." It's just, I don't want
to. You can paint shit on my head, but don't put scars or other weird prosthetics.
Fine, and they'll just put this thing on this on his cheek. Great. So yeah, it's a recommendation with a caveat. So I'd say it's a movie that doesn't really work for like I don't know. I don't know what kind of an unwashed nerd you'd have to be to kind of go like, yeah, this is amazing. Wow. No. this is a movie for movie nerds. And then only for this one sitting to say like, this is where James Horner started. And this is where James Cameron started. That's pretty much where I'm at. So top three moments and we're out of here, right? And bottom threes.
Top three. Why is this? Okay. Top three moments. Well, sassy AI lady. Very, very fun character.
Sassy
she has
AI
to be
lady,
a,
yes.
Sassy AI lady. She's the ship AI, whatever. Number two, the Akira Kurosawa and Agnes Varda filmmaking references that made me smile. I was kind of like, nice. That's fun. That's cool. All right. But number three, a quote on that space station that we talked about with the androids. There's the whole like subplot of the father of this girl that's living there is kind of like, I want him to be with a man, blah blah blah, and the protagonist says, "You're telling me I should breed with your daughter," and I started laughing like crazy during that.
This totally escaped me. Like, I was just like, oh yeah, this was it. When I was rereading the synopsis, I was just like, how did I forget this? This is how forgettable this shit is.
Some of the most iconic quotable lines from the movie.
Wow.
Jakub, how about you?
Okay, top three. I've got an honorable mention for Nestor, which is the sort of the white guys with a sticker on their forehead eating a hot dog, and all of them are chewing, and he immediately tells Papad that there's no dog in there, and he just lists the ingredients. It's just such a bizarre thing. But actually, the great moment in the film is the assault with all these soldiers and mercenaries and blaster fight, and it's very sort of inspired by Star Wars, and that would be kind of like Slash with this sort of great battle scene with James Horner sort of proto aliens moment. Mm-hmm. Another one would be beginning of the film with this massive ship coming out of nowhere, like when they have this sort of farming community which looks like Tatooine, right? And then this ship coming into the frame, I think in a rear projection, because it kind of just
looks like it. Yeah,
but it's honestly, that's a great shot. Like, just I really like it, and the model's amazing. It's great. And then the best moment in the sequence, actually the best sequence in the film that's suspenseful, it makes kind of sort of sense. It's a bit cheap, but yeah, the torture sequence and the assassination scene for some reason he has like deteriorating body, and I didn't even know, right? But then they torture a guy who's part of this like collected consciousness, and he takes his hand, and it's like this is a clever way of actually finding out what he knows, because then he has access to all their brains, but then they have access to his hand, so they try to kill Seder with the hand he just got transplanted, and then he has to amputate the arm, and the whole sequence is quite nice. I don't know, I really liked it, and it was just, you know, those just like 3 minutes of just genuine suspense, which like he's like when John Saxon's just trying to just slit his own throat with his Vulcan hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's my top three with an honorable mention. What about your bottoms? Show me your bottoms.
I don't like Cowboy. Cowboy is a tired character. It doesn't need to exist in this movie.
True.
I'm not a fan of the star backgrounds, if it makes sense. Like, they look, of all the cheap things in this movie, which are plenty, and I accept most of them pretty much, but the star backgrounds, like, you can tell it's a background. Just something with a perspective. Just so
like it's,
odd.
It's a painted on background. Like, someone stood there and painted these dots.
Yes. I mean, they tried their hardest, gosh darn it. It's probably like the fifth time they were remaking it after Roger Corman came into the studio, so.
Yeah.
But lastly, what I really didn't like and wasn't a fan of is all the Star Wars references, because you can be as inspired as you want, fine, but if you are actually putting references and quotes to Star Wars, that's when you lose me. It's kind of like, and there's like early on, the kid, like the protagonist, Shad, whatever, he's like, oh, I can drive that junk pile, something like mm-hmm. that, about talking about the spaceship. He's like, oh, get it, the piece of junk. Junk piles.
That's Millennium Falcon. Oh, it's fastest than in the galaxy. Oh, okay.
It's literally like that's a reference. That's a direct reference. And there's like many of them.
Cowboy is a smuggler as well.
Cowboy is basically the thing, which again you can say connects to, because Magnificent Seven has the same thing of like the cowboy, he leaves and then he comes back. It's like fine, who cares?
Because Han Solo was basically based on the same character.
Yeah, so it's an endless cycle. And I don't like those things. Like, that was just shameless writing.
Yeah. Is that it?
Yeah.
Nice, short and sweet. So, I've got a few little moments. I'm just gonna, okay, I had like one honorable, okay, I'm gonna rearrange these things so I can put two of them in one, because they refer to the same thing. You know the reptiles guy, when he's, I think he's attacking, and he has this scream? Why? Yeah. Slash?
It's pain.
And then by the way, they casually say like, whoa, we feed this guy with people, and then they're like, that's okay. And then he has this sort of operation where they just cannibalize people. It's great. I don't know. And he has like these Oompa Loompas. It's just so weird. So that would be Slash. When I think it's Valkyrie, that's her name, is the person, I think, who, by the way, had a problem. They had to have her breasts taped onto to the suit because it kept popping off and you could see her tits. That's according to the set designer or someone, or like, I don't know, wardrobe person, that she had a massive problem with, you know, having the costume stay on. Anyway, so when she screams, she's like, there's this ADR child scream, like, like weird. Anyway, the third eye sticker, like, fucking really? Like, it's like, you can see it's just like, stay still, stay, there it is. It's on your forehead now. Like, it's just like someone drew it with crayons and just, there it is, on your forehead. That's, like, can you please? Like, I know it doesn't cost much money, but yeah. But the absolute worst moment, which I don't understand why, there's this scene with Chad. Who, by the way, he looks like Nicholas Holt. just saying.
The bargain bin version of Nicholas Holt.
Bargain bin Nicholas Holt. He has this sort of moment with this woman on this planet, and they talk about like, there's three genders. Oh no, there's only two. And then, is there kissing in your species? And then he's like, it sure is. Like the pillow talk. can just fucking go. and I'm just thinking to myself, like, she clearly doesn't know if they have kids. Like, what if kissing means something else? What if he goes like, is there kissing in your species? And then just like, you know, and he goes like, yeah, and he just unzips. It's just that's what we do. And it's just it's very odd. It's such a weird scene. It's just like, why? Why can we? It's just this hold me sort of Luke and Leia bullshit.
I think the wiki can explain all of that.
It's such a I don't know. But it's like 3 minutes. Like I like when they're eating hot dogs. There's comedy in there. I suppose there's comedy in this because there's just like, oh, we don't know. But the guy's just like, either doesn't know how to act or he's actively trying to like compensate for the fact that the script's such a pile of shit that he's trying to make fun of this and making this intentionally camp, but he can't pull this off and it just this doesn't stick. So yeah, this is me and and Battle Beyond the Stars, which, you know, can be rented or purchased if you live in the US. I think on all major platforms. Elsewhere, I think you're on your own. I'm not sure. Is it on Prime in Italy? Please tell me
it's
on Prime.
It's not on Prime. It's on YouTube, though, if you want.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say, because it is on YouTube, at least in two places. Although the transfer on this is horseshit. I watched it on YouTube. So, you know, go and find it. It's on YouTube. And I think it's 3 minutes shorter than officially should be, because once the credits roll, it's like done. We're done.
That's how I like it.
So if there is a post-credit scene in Battle Beyond the Stars, I have not seen it because I watched it on YouTube.
It's the teaser for the sequel. Never happened.
Is there a sequel? Please tell me there is a sequel. When they got George Papar, it's like, oh, fine, I'll do it again.
God, no, please.
Yeah, so I think that's it. We did it. So where can we find you on social media? Nick, tell me where I can find you on social media.
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at NickyRan97, and there you can find me linktree.com/enjoythemovies, where you find links to all my short films and videos, and also go listen to the Death by Adaptation podcast, where every 2 weeks me and my good buddy Ewan Gledow pick a book and talk and compare and contrast it against its cinematic adaptations.
Fabulous. And you can find me at Talk About Film on Twitter, and you can also read my stuff on Clapper and on flashandfilm.com, and also on Letterboxd as Jakob Flash. You can also follow the show on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at Uncut Gems Pod is where we are. You can also find us on our website, uncutgemspodcast.com. So this is where you'll find all the archival episodes, links to everything, links to the Patreon, everything. And by the way, Patreon, $3 a month, patreon.com/uncutgemspod. Tie-ins, retrospectives, and our David Lynch marathon is all there. And now we have, I think, by the time you're listening to this, there's like 13 podcasts at least to listen to. So there's plenty of stuff to dig into for just $3. So join us if you can. And then, you know, if you want to support us in a different way, you can always buy us a coffee at ko-fi.com. So that's ko-fi.com/uncutgemspod. You can just buy us a coffee there. And alternatively, if you don't want to dish out any money and you still want to help, you can always leave us a review and a rating somewhere where you're listening to your podcast. So if the app you're listening through allows leaving that kind of feedback, please do so. It really helps us a lot if we get some ratings and reviews. So that's about everything I wanted to say. So stay tuned until next week, as we'll be starting our Shapeshifters and Body Snatchers series in our main show with the 1951, I think it's 51, the Thing from Another World. And by the way, by the time, I think it's 51, is it 51?
It is,
yeah. Jesus. yeah, double check my notes. It is. that's in addition to the tie-in episode that should be available on our Patreon at the time of this being released, which is the bonus tie-in for May, which is the 1978 remake of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So we'll be talking about The Thing from Another World, and then I will hope to see you there. So in the meantime, I hope you have a fabulous day. We'll see you next week. Bye.